This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and thank you very much for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen, he's Ewan McElraith. We're standing here listening to the seagulls on an overcast, slightly shmurry Scottish morning. It's not too bad.
Just a hint of autumn in the air.
Don't start that.
Swallows are kind of ganging up and getting on the telegraph lines, looking longingly at Africa and the sunshine. You can see their point. A lot of great stuff in this podcast. I've been looking at an amazing story about folk who live in caves on the north coast.
I actually went to visit, it's a fringe show, because obviously the Edinburgh Festival and Fringe are on at the moment. It's a fringe show, but unlike just about any other that you'll see anywhere in over 3,000 shows on this year. It's at the Royal Botanic Garden in Edinburgh, and it is beautiful. It's a way of getting an insight into a part of Scotland that very few people go to, but really worthwhile. Fantastic.
You get a kickback for that?
Not in the slightest.
3,000 shows, lots of producers and actors giving their eye teeth and the feet, shoes off their feet to get publicity, and you're throwing it away.
Just like that. This week, as you're probably aware, is Community Land Week. Over 50 events taking place across the country to highlight a new generation of landowners. We spoke quite some time ago about the island of Ulva. That was taken over by the community a year ago. I've also visited the Douglas Estate near Cope Bridge, where the View Park Conservation Group have just been awarded a grant for what is the largest ever acquisition of urban land. Now, most of the community buyouts have been things like islands or remote communities. This is actually bang smack in the middle of a built-up area. Grace McNeil is the chair of the Conservation Group.
We are standing on the road bridge over the M8. On that side of us, there is quite a patch of land, you know, mature trees and things and fields. Yes. On this side, we've got the old farm and some farmland. You've got some cattle in the fields here.
Yes.
What is it you want to do with this place?
We decided that the only way that we could protect it forevermore was to get it into the hands of the community, who want it kept as a green belt and a green lung for the people. Uh-huh. As you can see, we're divided up by motorways. It's like a triangle, and View Park is in the centre. So we decided that we had lost enough space to go out and roam. I know that Strathclyde Park is up the road, but not everybody's got a vehicle to get to it. Not everybody's got the money to go to all the other parks that cost money to get in. This is 170 acres of land that anybody can walk through. As I said, they can hug a tree, they can walk, they can picnic, or they can just go and sit in a field and get peace and quiet and be healthy.
It's up to them.
Yes.
And you say, you know, you felt the need to buy this big tranche of land to protect it from what? What was happening? I mean, aside from the motorways, what was happening
right
to it?
There was a proposal for the second part of the Strathclyde Business Park, which was 2- and 3-storey buildings all the way down to Baileson. We were having to watch planning all the time and make sure that nobody else got their hands on it and everything, and would stop the locals getting in to use it, because they've used it for about the past 50 years. It was a private estate, but people came in anyway because it was so tempting. Just people wanted to walk through it, play in it, swim in it.
You get the feeling there ought to be a big house somewhere.
There is. There was 2 or 3 buildings in it. There was Rose Hall House, which was also called Hags, and that goes away back into the Hamiltons and everything, and away back into Covenanting times and everything as well. It's Douglas trustees that are in charge of it just now, and we've been very lucky with them because they're giving us a willing sale. Uh-huh. Because they want it preserved as well for the history.
What does that mean, a willing sale?
The government got the land from a compulsory purchase, and they're giving us a reasonable price.
Okay.
So
the government bought the land for the motorway.
Yes.
Through compulsory purchase.
Yes.
And everything else aside from that, you're getting willingly from the trustees.
Yes.
Okay.
And I must admit, we were cheeky, first of all, and asked it for a copper. But in these days of finance, and to prove that we're able to get money and keep it going, I suppose it's not unreasonable that they asked us for a sum of money to buy it, which we were lucky enough through the land fund. Yep. We succeeded in getting the land fund. We didn't get everything that we asked for because there was an awful lot of other groups in for their projects, which meant so much to them as well. But because the land fund, people came out and looked at it, and I think they fell in love with it right away when they seen it as well, and thought it should be saved for the future, for all the next generations.
I really admire the fact that you've done this. It will be the biggest urban land purchase in Scotland to date. I understand precisely why you're doing it, but you're not land managers. You don't have experience in this kind of thing. What are you going to use it for? How are you going to physically manage it?
Right. We are bringing in the Greening Trust. They used to be the Scottish Land Trust, and they are going to help us manage the woods and the forests. We are getting help from Archaeology Scotland, who are going to help us bring back the vaults and the tombs and highlight some of the historical bits. We've pinpointed people who are good at what they do and asking them to come on board and help us. We're employing a project manager to manage the projects when they're being done, and we're employing a land manager and some rangers to look after the land.
Next obvious question, where's the money coming from? I mean, you know, the land fund will give you money for capital costs, but yes. In terms of day-to-day running?
We are getting some lottery funding to help with the cost for the wages. We're going to do pop-up events and basically just pray we get the rest of it. But it will happen. I can honestly tell you, I sat up in bed one morning and I thought, be careful what you ask for, because it's happened, and then you sort of, the reality hits you, and then you've got to think, but if we got this far, we'll get further. So the rest of the group are an awful lot younger than us.
Well, fair enough, I was going to ask that, because how big a team have you got? Because quite often with things like this, it's, you know, it's somebody older, somebody who's got a bit more time on their hands, you know, and that, you know, they're absolutely focused and they're absolutely determined, but folk get older still.
Yeah. You know? Well, we've got a
succession.
Yes. They're ranging from 70 down to, I think the youngest member we've got now is 14, and they're all hands-on like us. And when it comes to events and different things, they've all got their own speciality thing as well. Yeah. Quite a lot of people that are unemployed just now, looking for work, and the tradesmen and different things said, give me a shout when you're needing the house renovated. We'll give you a hand to clean up the woods. We'll give you a hand to do this. So these are all the bits that we're going to tap into now to actually get the physical work done. And we're going to get training for people to use the power tools, which gives them a ticket to even help the people go and get a job. Yeah. So good will come from it as well.
How did you, I mean, over the years, how did you used to use this place?
Well, I lived in Coatbridge, right? And Tom lived in View Park. I was told to stay away from this place because all the bad boys were over there. So
it was like a magnet, a moth to the flame.
So we used to come walking down, and I met Tom at the gate up there, because he used to could get straight through into Kirkshaws. And we've been together ever since. When I was 15, I met him, and we're still together. And I don't know, it just, you try to get away from it, it just doesn't let you get away. This place, it kidnaps you. Our children used to come down here, picnics. They used to come down and play in the river. So a lot of the time, the young boys, they were going down drinking and everything. So we started having fishing competitions. So Tom had given a lot of them fishing equipment, and they were all catching fish. So the boys now don't spend as much on drinking alcohol. They're saying, I want a better seat, I want a better rod, I want bait. And they still go and get their carry out and go and sit at the river and drink. That is their social way of doing it. But now they've got a purpose.
Grace McNeil of the View Park Conservation Group. Is that just not sensible?
Yeah, it's kind of, it is sensible, isn't it? But a whole new approach to community buyouts, as you say. A lot of them, you tend to think of islands, remote areas, but, you know, slap bang in the middle of the city.
Yeah.
And why not?
I think part of the problem with urban buyouts is actually delineating what the border is. You know, got an island, when you get wet, you stop. That's it, you come to the edge.
when it's something like this, obviously because it was a former estate, you know, and it is delineated essentially by a wall on the outside, that's easier for them too. But you wonder why, you know, there aren't patches of land just suddenly being snapped up by the community in places like Edinburgh, Glasgow.
Yeah, but how do you define what that community is?
Well, exactly. That's your big problem right there. Yeah. We regularly bring you news of new initiatives and projects involving wildlife and the wider Scottish countryside.
Yeah, well, what's really good is to go back every now and again and see how they're progressing.
My name is Gabrielle Flynn and I work on the Rare Invertebrates in the Cairngorms project.
Now, we spoke about a couple of years ago at the launch of the project. Tell me what it is.
So the project has really been sort of encouraging members of the local community to go out and survey for these six rare species, and then we go to the landowners who have these species on their land and try and help them protect the species.
So what species are we talking about?
So we've got two moths, Kentish Glory and Dark Bordered Beauty. We've got Small Scabious Mining Bee, Shining Guest Ant, Northern Silver Stiletto Fly and Pine Hoverfly.
Just explain what these things are and why we should care.
So the six species were sort of picked partially because of their rarity. So nature is quite scarce in Britain now. We just have these little pockets of it. And so these species are really rare as well because they kind of have these really specific niches they need. But we really also want to protect these six species because they all live in really unique and important habitats. So we wanted to raise awareness about those habitats as well.
You relied heavily on volunteers, or you were intending to rely on volunteers to get out and survey for the various species. What's been the reaction?
Great. We're still getting, every week we're getting people emailing and saying, can I be involved in the project? From all over Scotland as well. We have folk from Edinburgh, Aberdeen, Glasgow who all want to come and just and sort of get involved in preserving the beauty of Scotland.
So what do they have to do?
So they come along to a training day, they learn about how to identify the species, how to look for them, and then they go out with this new knowledge and they find these species, give us the data, and then we speak to the landowners.
Is it quite difficult to get the data?
No, sometimes it is because they're obviously very rare, so it's sometimes hard to find them. But for things like Kentish Glory, we've actually used pheromone lures to try and find them. So it makes it a bit easier because then they come to us.
Well, what does a Kentish Glory look like?
It's very orange and fluffy. It's quite a big moth and it's a beautiful little species.
It's not just rare because it's not in Kent.
Yeah, it's definitely not in Kent anymore. So the reason that things like Kentish Glory are rare is because massive loss of habitat, so loss of woodland, loss of woodland diversity, but also things like climate change come into play. So you'll find a lot of species of butterflies and moths are moving further northwards as habitat becomes less suitable down south.
So here we are 2 years in. Are you getting any interesting results?
We're getting amazing results. So we've found things like Small Scabious Mining Bee in seven new areas across the national park. We've also been collecting behavioural data, so we're learning about the different species, which helps us to conserve them. We are doing partnership projects with people like Royal Zoological Society Scotland, and we have a captive breeding programme going with pine hoverfly. We've had over 40 volunteers at one point, all running around the countryside looking for Kentish Glory.
So there's a lot more interest in it. You touched on the fact you're still getting volunteers. Have you got capacity for more volunteers?
We do. The project's definitely growing, and hopefully the second version of the project will have even more staff working on it to sort of help with all this interest.
Is it just in the national park?
Yes, it's just in the national park at the moment, but there's lots of other exciting similar projects going on across Scotland.
So what's been the reaction from landowners so far?
Mostly great. We work with farmers, we work with estates, and they're always usually interested. It's just very occasionally we'll have one or two who maybe don't want to be involved, but the major sort of reaction has just been found it interesting, the quirky animals living on their land. And they're just...
Are you asking them to change the way they manage the land? Or is it the fact that they've got them there in the first place means they're doing it right?
Yeah, so most of the time they're already doing something that's really great. And so we just tell them what they're doing really well. And usually they're really interested and they ask what they can do more to help. So we have a farmer near Grantonons Bay who's a particularly great guy. And he's helping us conserve two of the species. So he asks, what more can I do? And that's really great. And we also give the data to the National Parks. So should any development projects come up, they have that data so they know what they need to mitigate for.
What can you do to actually help these species, say if you're in the national park and you've got a new project?
What we can do to help these species is we could cut grass less so that we have more wildflowers. I think we all know that now. We need wildflowers for our pollinators and we need pollinators for our food. Also having diverse woodland and native woodland, so having Scots pine woodland and birch and lots more aspen. So just increasing the amount of native woodland we have and really recovering the Scottish countryside.
But you know, native woodland's a much longer term project, but not cutting grass verges, for example.
Yeah, that's an instant fix. You'll see some parts of the Central Belt now, particularly in Edinburgh, where they're just letting the grass grow and you see all these flowers coming up and bees and butterflies are back. It's that easy.
What about this? I mean, we're in a field of thistles and there's loads of butterflies around. Some would say this is ugly and you should trim it.
That's just fashion, isn't it? We need to change fashion.
Is it doable?
I think it's absolutely doable. Colour is better than just green, isn't it?
Gabrielle Flynn of the Rare Invertebrates Project in the Cairngorms. And one of the things that lots of people have been talking about this year, this summer, is, you know, the sudden appearance of hundreds and thousands of painted lady butterflies.
Yeah, they came up. The warm conditions in Europe and the southerly winds have brought an absolute massive influx. Yeah. Hundreds of thousands in the south of England. And we're getting the tail end of that, but it's just beautiful to see.
Here's a question. What do butterflies do in torrential rain?
Shelter.
How? Where?
They get
little bus shelters.
They get under a little tree.
Ah.
And you'll see lots of them at the moment going around sheds and garages. Ah. And looking for somewhere to rest up for the night. Because you see them at the start of next year. The ones from last year really faded and a bit drab as opposed to the new fresh ones. But yeah, they're looking for somewhere to go and spend the winter.
We used to live in a cottage beside the Forth and Clyde Canal, and we had a problem one time with the hot water because it was a back boiler, basically. So there was something going wrong with the tank. You know, it was just a single-storey cottage, but the tank was up on the roof. So I climbed up on the roof of my house with a torch. And the temperature up there, the tank had been boiling, essentially. The lid was actually off it. So it was hot, it was steamy, and it was full of Red Admiral butterflies.
Brilliant.
They must have got in there. And I don't know whether that actually encouraged them to hatch or whatever. I mean, that was entirely the wrong time of year, and they all died, unfortunately. But quite unusual. On that cheery note.
Happy note.
This, as I've said, is festival time in Edinburgh, both the official international festival and the Fringe. As we're recording this, it's just about to enter its second week. It is an astonishing artistic lineup. As we said earlier, over 3,000 shows this year at the Fringe. Arguably, possibly just a bit too much.
You could possibly do that. I mean, I go there and I appreciate the big cultural thing and it's a great influx of money. Mm-hmm. Just gets too much for me every now and again.
The noise. You go, noise and the number of people.
You go home and suddenly there's peace and calm and tranquility.
Yeah. But if you're in Edinburgh, you know, and you've been doing the show thing, you want to escape the madness but still take in an event, go to the Royal Botanic Garden in Edinburgh. You can find an event called Below the Blanket, which is inspired by the landscape of the Flow Country in Sutherland. It is balm to the soul. Kathy Boyd is the artistic director.
So what we're hearing is a work made by Kathy Hind. And as you see, we have these incredible looking speakers within the Botanic Gardens. And these are actually based on the design of a bog bean.
Yes, yes.
But what we're listening to is sounds taken by hydrophonic microphone. Uh-huh. And Kathy did these deep listening walks up in the Flow Country.
Uh-huh.
And the microphones were actually put in to the bogs themselves,
beautiful.
And that's what you're hearing.
Uh-huh. I'm just going to move slightly towards this, try not to crush the plants, but listen to this.
Each one's different for you.
It looks for all the world like car exhaust pipe sticking up with almost like a sort of half-metal ball on the top, and that sort of reflects the sound.
Yeah.
But the sounds are unworldly.
Yeah. We start Below the Blanket here, and she's basically starting us in the blanket bog. That's what I love. And then as we continue through the journey, she takes other recordings. And there's about 12 of these speakers around us. And you have to sort of find them. But you can hear them all around us. So Kathy's quite an amazing artist. She's a musician, professional musician trained, and also went to art school, visual artist.
That's so she hears the music and things.
Yeah, and it's why they look so stunning to look at these. And she very much works with nature and technology, so you really get a sense of that here. So here we have a piece of Kathy's called Water Balance. It's based on the Japanese system, Oshi-Oshi. So they fill up with water.
Basically, there's water dribbling into a hanging pipe.
Yeah.
And when it achieves a certain weight, it counterbalances. It's pivoted.
Yeah.
It counterbalances, it comes down, and it hits this symbol.
Yeah. The way it's programmed is it's never the same. So sometimes they might all go together, uh-huh. and sometimes individually.
Let's just listen to it. This is happening over a pond which is surrounded by trees.
And this is the one wild area of the garden which actually most of the people coming to the show have said to me, I've never seen that part of the botanics before.
No.
And it's also the area which most represents the flow country.
Well, when I first went up to Forsenard, you know, from my head to comprehend that, you know, beneath the bogs are 10 metres of peat. Mm-hmm. And then you think, how many millions of years has that taken to actually form? It's extraordinary, and actually what it's doing, you know, regarding climate change, because the flow country holds more carbon than twice the size of UK forestry.
Yes.
So what they're doing is really, really important for the environment, and we must protect it.
So here, we have Cathy's recording of the wind. So what we're hearing now are the Aeolian harps. And this is glorious. You can pick up all the different textures. So we started underground and now we're above ground. And many of these effects were created. Well, Aeolian harp is obviously metal vibrating in the wind. And without the wind, you wouldn't have any sound. And the glorious thing about the flow country, there's plenty of wind.
Let's just listen to it.
Really important for me in making this work that it was about a solitary experience, so you can go around the gardens, read about the flow country, see beautiful images of the flow country, and listen to soundscapes on your own, which actually is calming and is a complete escapism from the madness going on up the road. This is a beautiful choral work that we've composed along with the RSPB, and it's by Malcolm Lindsay, sung by the Dunedin Concert. And for Fridays in the Botanics, we have them singing this live.
Mm-hmm.
So sadly, we're not here tonight when they're live, so you could have put up with the speaker.
That is a shame. That is a real shame, yeah.
The whole idea of this for me, and why did I want this moment in the journey? You know, because all the other soundscapes in Below the Blanket are all electronic. And I wanted a choral moment,
mm-hmm.
and I have a huge passion for choral music, where the public can just close their eyes and go to the flow country and see it and imagine it after seeing all the images earlier on the journey.
I would never want to take this down in the Botanic Gardens. I think that's a lovely idea.
Cathy Boyd and More Sounds of the Flow Country is recreated in the Botanics in Edinburgh, coming up shortly. Also, a really brilliant thing they've done with umbrellas. We'll explain that in the next bit. You're listening to the Scotland Outdoors podcast from BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElraith.
Yeah, you can download the free Scotland Outdoor podcast. It's available from BBC Radio Scotland websites. And we do like hearing about where you listen. You can email your stories to outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, which is what Penny Pitts did. She said, I'm one of your international podcast listeners, of which there are many, and of which we're eternally grateful. I live and work in the south of Israel, in the Arava Desert. I'm a date farmer, and usually tune into the programme while walking around the grove and checking the irrigation on the 7,000 or so date palms in my care.
She goes on, I felt compelled to drop you a line after last Saturday's podcast, where one of the presenters, I think it was me, mentioned that he had recently seen swifts above his house, having never seen them in that location before. I have the privilege of living below the migration route between Africa and Europe. I'm treated twice a year to the spectacle of buzzards, eagles, storks, cranes, and a host of smaller birds migrating. Amongst their number are the swifts and swallows, whom I always greet in March and April when they pass through bound for Europe with a hearty, safe journey and see you in Blighty. I visit family and friends in the UK, so do indeed see them there.
Yeah, I've seen, I've been up in the mountains seeing the honey buzzard migration. It's just fantastic seeing all these birds of prey. But she goes on saying, naturally, the same birds make their way back to Africa in the autumn. This year, I noticed that even as early in July, the swifts and the swallows are already passing through. That's 3 months earlier than usual. What's going on, she would like to know. Well, Penny, we're not too sure. Certainly loads of swallows and swifts and martins still in our neck of the woods. But if anybody's out there and knows why there's more swallows going past Penny, email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk.
I sat on a bench at Portobello on the outskirts of Edinburgh just yesterday afternoon.
You live life to the full.
I tell you, just a wild man. Everything but a tartan travel rug and a thermos flask. And it had been really quite a bad morning. I mean, quite torrential rain and gusty and windy. And then in the afternoon, it just dried up, cleared away. Aye, on that side of the Forth, it was still hideous. You could see across in the
Even
Fife
better.
Side. Yeah, exactly. But on the beach in front of me, there were swifts and swallows hawking. And just, I don't know, 20 metres away, black-headed gulls, terns, all sorts. I'm a real mixture of wildlife.
Why leave Edinburgh when you can see it on the beach?
Too straight. We first came across a guy called Willie Anderson when we made a programme about the River Forth a couple of years ago. Now, Willie's a local historian and gave us the lowdown on the Kincardine and Clackmannan area. But when we got there,
yeah, we turned up in a Reliant Robin, which, if you don't know what it is, it's a very little three-wheel car that was very popular for a while. And he took us across the bridge.
There was no reason to do this. We just wanted a shot in the Robin.
So you're in the front because you can fit in the back.
No.
I'm curled up in the back on top of a toolbox, and off we went. And he hurtled it around this roundabout, and you're fearing for your safety. And I said, have you ever couped it? Expecting the answer. No, it's safe. He says, no, yeah, every week. Just get out and pick it back
up. Just get out and just shove it back on its feet again. Willie's son recently got in touch to tell us about the restoration work his dad's been doing at a Kincardine churchyard. So I went along to meet up with him again.
This is the old kirkyard in Kincardine. It's the second church in Kincardine. The first one was further up near the sand quarry. It got too small for the population, so they decided to come here, and it was late 1600s. This church was built, and the graveyard goes with the church.
This is going to sound a bit weird, but I'm a wee bit of a connoisseur of graveyards.
Are you?
I like graveyards, and this is a cracker. I mean, just as soon as you walk in, you start to see carvings and stones, and there's a density to these carvings that's really unusual.
The quality of this carving is because the local stone was that good, it didn't weather.
Aye.
Some of these are 300 year old.
Wow.
And you can still read them. This fella here was a baker.
Uh-huh.
You had the baker's peel.
That looks like a pizza shovel.
Aye. Well, that's the peel for taking the stuff out. That's the brush for cleaning the bottom of the oven, you know.
There's a lot of these stones have got the skull and the cross bones. And I remember doing a school project once with my daughter's class, and they were saying, pirates! And I'm like, not quite.
Bill Woolsey, the fellow that restored it with me, he used to take groups for in for the school, and that was one of the first questions they asked us. Is it true there's pirates buried here? He said, and when he said no, they were quite disappointed.
These are unusual too. I mean, basically, instead of, if you think of a monolith, what tends to be, it stands up on its thin end, and you've got the height. This is lying on its side. This is very unusual.
But you'll see, on the top, you see?
You take the lichen off it.
Aye, it says three layers. Sometimes it says three rooms. So there's three graves side by side.
Ah.
So they own that three graves there, you know, again.
So effectively, this is almost like laying down a beach towel
on your homology and saying,
this is our bit, this is our family layer.
Aye.
But some I've of never them, seen that before.
Some of them's two rooms, some of them's two layers or three layers, you know. Three's the biggest I've seen, you know, Ken.
And I mean, another thing that just jumps straight out at me, it's in good nick.
Was it always like that?
It
was usually not too bad, but some of them had sunk end on into the ground by a block and tackle of a tripod, and we lifted them back up to the right height. And Bill,
well, just off your own bat?
Aye, Bill Woolsey and I. And folks, Bill did a lot of talks for different groups.
Aye.
And the one
guerrilla
question...
Guerrilla restoration.
The one question was, how did you get permission? He says, we never asked. He was a farrier.
Aye.
Which is different for a blacksmith.
Aye.
Because a farrier...
Shoes horses. So you've got the hammer and you've got the horseshoe.
But the crown is for the Hammerman's Guild.
Ah,
that one, you see, has got a hammer and a crown. Uh-huh. He was just a hammerman.
Okay.
But he could have been a silversmith or a goldsmith.
See, that's a mason's hammer down there.
Aye. And the square and the compasses.
Uh-huh. So probably been a mason as well.
Aye.
Lovely ship carving here.
If you look,
it's not lovely, but you know, it is definitely a ship carving.
Every ship is different. Uh-huh. There's one there. There's another one there, but there's a difference. If you look, the sail pattern's different or the hull shape is different. It was this, we reckon it was this man's ship.
Aye.
He was a weaver.
Yes, aye.
The shuttle and comb for the weaver. We reckoned he belonged to the village. We reckon he sailed with Admiral Lord Keith.
Aye.
I mean, at that time, junior seaman or whatever he was could afford a stain of that quality.
That's a cracker.
That one's the best one. That's one of the oldest stains in the graveyard. If you put chalk on it, hang me, you can read it. But it says, as you are now, so once was I. As I am now, so you shall be. Repent your sins and follow me. And Bill went round a lot of graveyards, and he was in one at Dunblane at the cathedral, and there was a big stone with that on it, but there was a bare bit underneath. And somebody in chalk had written, to follow you, I'd be content if only I knew which way you went.
How did this survive, though? I mean, you get the feeling it's almost like a sort of time capsule.
It's a locked gate, and it's always been a locked gate, as far as we know, because...
See, that would just have annoyed me as a child, out of climbed the wall.
Well, that's what the kids did. Yeah. My kids did it, and nearly every bairn in the village did it.
Uh-huh.
You know, but there was little or no vandalism in this graveyard that we could see. I mean, stains had fell out, but, I mean, they fall out with age sometimes, yeah? When we were restoring it, some of the stains we couldn't sort. Were beyond your ability. And the Mitchells, who, this is their family lair in here, and they owned the police college at the castle at one time. They'd seen what we were doing, and they went to Bill and they said to him, look, what's your ultimate aim? And he says, well, we'll repair what we can, but there's some that are beyond your ability. And he says, oh, well, we'll get somebody to do it. And they got professional masons for Edinburgh, and they came and they put in steel pins and resin, and they joined the ones that we couldn't do. And the bill was over £10,000, again. But he said that the reason these were hanged was they cut across the grain to get a bigger stain, whereas these ones were cut along the grain, which they lasted longer.
Yeah. The church itself,
aye.
Can you get into that?
No, it's locked. There's grills on it.
Let me just have a quick shifty in this, because there's a gate here, but it's almost like a wee garden of remembrance inside it.
Aye. Well, the Mitchell family, they come here for abroad and get buried. Again.
Where abroad?
Bermuda.
Wow. Oh, so you die in Bermuda and you come back here.
Aye. Familiar.
People must be really surprised, thinking as sort of genealogists and things, if you're trying to trace your family history, this is here, and it's here in some detail.
But it's on the net. My son put it on the net, because when we did it, he said, that should be on the internet, Dad. And I didn't know one end of the net for the other, you know. And I thought a net was for fishing with him. And he said, I'll put it on. Photograph the ones with the carvings. And they're on the net. See that one? It's the Gibb family. Now, one of them, there were two brothers, were ship's captains, and they swapped ships. Uh-huh. I think it was either Liverpool. I think it was Liverpool. They swapped ships. And he went to Australia, and the ship foundered on Muttonbird Island in the south of Australia. Windjammers, there was a passage you took that was the safe one for ships. He took the wrong one. Two people survived, but a day or 2 days after the ship had sunk, a case floated ashore, and in it was a giant China peacock. It was for an exhibition in Australia, and it's now called the Loch Ard peacock. and there was only a minute chip on the beak. Wow. All these people died, and yet that thing survived.
Willie Anderson at the Tully Allen Old Kirkyard. And if you want to see pictures of the stones, go to our Facebook page. That's Out of Doors. That peacock Willie was mentioning, the Lockhart peacock, is enormous. And it's on display at something called the Flagstaff Hill Maritime Museum at Warrnambool in Victoria, Australia.
Yep, I went to school there. In Warrnambool. Really? Yeah, that's where you've got this accent that...
Have you ever thought about suing?
No, Warrnambool's a fantastic place. Very green, big open spaces and... Well, it's changed a lot now, but it was right on the cusp of the... You get out there and you get into the outback, it's just brilliant. Yeah. Lovely part of the world.
Does sound rather nice.
We had platypuses. Sorry to interrupt, it's coming back now.
Okay, it's all coming back now.
We were in a house in the north of the town then, and it was an old Victorian swing bridge, wooden, and there was platypuses. You could just look over the edge and be platypuses everywhere, swimming about in the water.
There's a lovely gag from Round the Horn, I think it is. He says, what are we having for dinner tonight? Platypus flambé. Says we would be, but the platypus keeps on blowing the match out. Let's stick with local history, because tracing your ancestors is a popular way to find out a bit more of where your family actually came from. But you met a lady the other day. She's got a fantastic story.
I met a lady called Fiona Lockhead, who lives there in Lossiemouth, and she was digging into the past, and it threw up an amazing connection, which threw light onto a secret that most of us didn't even think existed.
So this is Cowsea Caves at Cowsea Beach.
Just underneath the very dominant Stevenson Lighthouse there.
Yes.
It's a fantastic beach, windswept, wild sea. It's a rugged place on a day like today.
It certainly is, yes.
Now, you've been digging around a wee bit and you came up with an incredible story. Talk me through what happened.
Yeah, that's right. I've been doing some family history and I discovered that my great-grandmother was actually living in the caves here in the 1901 census.
Why were they living in caves?
That's a question I've been asking myself over and over. I knew that my family came from travellers, but I certainly was surprised to find them living in the caves. That was not something that I had been aware of as being part of their history. But it turns out that many of the family lived in caves dotted around the Murray coast.
So would they be living here permanently?
They would have been wintering over and stopping over en route. They worked from Orkney through to Aberdeen via Caithness, selling their wares. They were tinsmiths.
So how did you find it? How did you discover it?
I'd been doing family history for all of the family, and I discovered my great-grandmother here, which was a surprise to me because we had no connections with the area. But when I looked closer at the census, it recorded them as living in caves. And that led to me wanting to find out a lot more about the family and what they were doing here.
And you tracked down a photograph as well.
Yeah, it was amazing. I went to Elgin Library and showed them the census returns with my ancestors living in the caves. And they showed me some pictures of the caves. And lo and behold, in the first picture they showed me was my great-great-great-great-grandfather, Geordie Lindsay.
That must have been an unbelievable moment.
It was an unbelievable moment. I don't have any pictures of that side of my family at all. So it was a very special moment. Kind of gave my, hairs in the back of my neck. Yes.
And we're in front of the very cave at the moment.
That's right. We're standing in front of the cave here.
There's obviously a bit of construction being done when he was living here.
Yeah, he did fashion some sort of gate to block off the worst of the winter weather, I guess.
Well, let's go in a wee bit and get out of the rain. Because, if you look back out, I thought this would be a miserable experience living in a cave. Mm-hmm. But you're looking out on a beautiful beach, beautiful sea. You can imagine the kids playing in the water. I'm painting an idyllic picture that probably never existed.
Well, it certainly does look idyllic, but the realities of living in a cave would have been quite different, I think. It's very cold and damp in here. This is the height of Scottish summer. I'm currently wearing a hat. I can't imagine what it must have been like in those winter months, but it did provide respite from the Scottish winter, kept them safe, kept them secure. So it served its purpose.
It's not a huge cave. It's about the size of a flat, I suppose.
No, I believe that it was much bigger, though, because I think over the last 100 years there's been a build-up of sand. I think that there was a much more extensive network of caves, so we're maybe not seeing... We're seeing the tip of the iceberg, perhaps, here.
And you can see, it looks like smoke, the remains.
Yes, the only picture that I have of the family in the cave shows a lot of soot. They had a fire burning. It would have been a very smoky environment to be in, but certainly cosy compared with what was beyond.
And you've got loads of graffiti up here. Just try read it. Williamson
That was a travelling name as well, wasn't it?
That's right.
And McGee?
McGee, that's definitely a travelling name. No, I think all sorts of people, settled people, travelling people, have come to these caves and have wanted to leave their mark in some way, perhaps.
It was 1885.
Yeah, that's right, yes. Yes, they've left their mark in lots of different ways.
So what were they doing here? Were they on the fringes of society?
I think that there is evidence that they were a very marginalised group, and that some of the pressures, not just weather pressures, but social pressures on them, led to them coming away from the settled community. They were living alongside them, doing the work of an itinerant worker, sometimes a little bit of tinsmithing. But there seemed to be an uneasy relationship, perhaps, with the host community. And perhaps, I can only speculate, perhaps that's one of the reasons that they chose to come and live here.
So presumably people died here, lived here, born here?
My great-great-grandfather's brother, Charles McPhee, lived and died in this cave. And he actually died here after cave dwelling was prohibited by an Act of Parliament.
Why was it banned?
So during the First World War, they wanted to stop people starting fires at the coastline. And so they passed an Act to stop people dwelling in caves. But it didn't necessarily seem to make a great deal of difference to the people that had made these caves their homes over the years.
So they were living here up until relatively recently?
Yeah, I believe that there were still people living here up until the 1930s. But my family, certainly, their link is from the time of the First World War.
So do you get that connection when you come in here, when you're on your own?
I'm looking for it. I think I'm looking for something. Maybe it's not there, but I am looking for it.
It's quite an enviable thing to have, though, that history.
It's an unusual thing to have. I'm not sure how enviable it is, but it's certainly been a fascinating discovery for me, mainly because I have so many questions about why they would have lived in that way, how it was for them. Still so many questions that I haven't found the answers to, but by connecting with travellers themselves, people who've grown up within that community, I've learned so much from listening to them.
But it's a real story that really deserves a bigger audience.
I knew nothing about this either, and I think that it is a story that needs to be heard, because it's interesting. It's part of our Scottish heritage.
Fiona Lockhead, and you'll be able to see and hear more about those caves at Cowsey and Lanwood on BBC Scotland in the coming weeks.
It's truly amazing. Imagine that, living somewhere. She's not from that part of Aberdeenshire.
Yeah.
Discovering her great-great-grandmother was possibly born and certainly lived in a cave a stone throw from your house. You know, a cave you've been in with your kids and your dogs.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, actually, my ancestors lived in this cave.
I'm trying to remember who it was I spoke to. I think it might have been Stanley Robertson, the traveller, a few years ago. But I think his mother was born in a cave.
I think it was absolutely widespread. Yeah. As Fiona was saying, there's a whole network of caves from Caithness all the way down that coast, both sides of the Murray Firth, and all inhabited by travellers.
Yeah.
It makes sense.
Not stone caves now, but caves made of green foliage. The Botanic Garden of Edinburgh, where, as part of the Edinburgh Festival, an event called Below the Blanket is taking place. Now, this is a series of artworks and ideas that have all been inspired by the Flow Country up in Sutherland. I was well taken by it. I just thought it was so calming and soothing after the sort of brouhaha and madness of actually being in the centre of town. I bumped into a couple of fellow visitors and said, look, OK, how was it?
I'm Ros.
Andy. Rod.
This has been the Edinburgh Festival first week, so I'm accustomed to seeing strange stuff wandering about. But there are three people with speakers attached to umbrellas, and they're light-up umbrellas too. Explain this. What's the thinking behind it?
Ah, so this is called a sonic umbrella.
Uh-huh.
And
well, like Doctor Who.
Yeah, so you can carry an experience of singing birds with you as you walk through beautiful botanic gardens.
It's very strange doing these sounds of the Flow Country surrounded by the exotica of the Botanic Gardens. There's a sort of a visual dissonance.
I think there's a skylark coming out of your one.
I think there is, yeah.
Yeah, that is nice. That is nice.
Yeah, I've got a lark now.
How have you found the installations running about the place? I mean, what's your reaction to them being?
Many of them are pretty good. I like the sound pieces most. Maybe not so much the art pieces, but the sound pieces.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that. Right at the very beginning, the sounds from the hydrophones from under the bog.
I love
and
that.
Walking up towards the pond and the transition. From one side, you've got the sounds underneath, and then the other side, you've got these sort of strange cymbals clinging away, and there's a great transition through that.
Yeah.
How does this compare with the other stuff that you've seen in Edinburgh so far, just as an overall experience?
This is the first thing I've seen.
It's a lovely experience, very different from, you know, thrashing your way through the high street.
They're obviously thoroughly enjoying the umbrellas. I mean, they're now about 150 metres ahead of us, and there's another couple with an umbrella. What was your thinking behind it?
Well, what I was really aware of is that often with sound, it's static. Mm-hmm. A speaker's in a tree, or it's hidden in the grass. You know, if you think of speakers in a living room, they're in one place. I wanted the public to be able to carry the sound with them. So actually, as you walk, the sound walks with you. Mm-hmm. And Cathy, of course, has made a beautiful recording of six birds that she recorded up in Flow Country with a beautiful piece of piano composition, I have to say.
Mm-hmm. Just listen to this. Yeah, I'm laughing because it's a red umbrella with red LED lights around the top, etc. And you can hear this. This is what you're carrying about above your head. Lapwing. Skylark.
I don't know that one. You got me.
Oh, no. I think that may...
Is that a waiter? Is
that a diver?
I thought it was a waiter. Yeah. I don't know.
What an absolutely lovely idea.
So this is a work called Data Flow by Matthew Alden. And he's taken scientific recordings from a scientist who's been working in research from Nottingham University, and it's 3 years of bog recordings, healthy and non-healthy bog. I think there's a non-graded one. And what he's done is he's taken each bog and converted it into specialisation, actually. Now, don't ask me which is the healthy and unhealthy bog, because to be honest, I've never wanted to find out. I just think it's something incredibly relaxing about it. And I love it as an example of how arts and science can come together.
We're standing in the middle of four or five trees, and there are cables strung about 10 feet up, and along the cables, about every metre and a half or so, there are these little speakers that are projecting this sound. But what this is, as you were saying, he's taken scientific data, data points on a chart or something like that, and mathematically converted it into music.
Yeah, I love these coders. I mean, this is what's extraordinary about, you know, today in music. You know, they're not writing, you know, dots on a page. You know, they can take this data and convert it through coding into music. Mm. He's quite a brilliant coder. Mm. But as you hear with these 96 speakers, they're literally moving around us, which is what I adore about it.
There are something like 3,000 shows on the Fringe at the moment. And if I had to put a recommendation for any one single show, just from the point of view of getting relief from the madness of the Edinburgh Festival and Fringe, it would have to be this one, not just for the art installations, which are wonderful, you know, the audio installations, but just the chance to walk through the garden.
It's the fact you're on your own. It's not a piece for the masses to herd through hundreds of people at a time, because you wouldn't actually get the feel of the Flow Country. When you're up there walking, you're alone. You're listening. You might have the old bird pass you. You know, you hear a crunch underfoot. And it's of course, it's incredibly difficult to bring that into the botanics. But I hope, as a result of this project, that people know more about the Flow Country, want to go to the Flow Country, but not too many. and it's important for what it's doing for the environment. Yeah.
Cathy Boyd, their artistic director of Below the Blanket, and the installations will be on display in the Botanic Gardens until the 25th of August.
It sounds fantastic, and I just love it when it actually works, because there's loads of shows, and sometimes they don't quite work, sometimes, seeing everybody, sometimes they're just a bit thrown together.
Yes.
Just have the experience, the fun of the festival. But some of that is craft and really moves you, I think, is...
That idea, the umbrella at the end, I know it sounds terribly gimmicky and gadgety, but you have to carry one of these things around to see the effect it actually has, because it's like being in a little sound booth, you know, and effectively you could build the battery pack into the handle or something like that. You've got the wee speaker, you've got just a wee sound chip, but you could change the tracks that are on that. So as you're walking through the city, not during the festival, any other time, as you walk through the city or town or whatever, you know, and you want to hear Sea Wash or you want to hear birdsong or whatever it is, etc., and you are in your little sound booth.
But you could do it the other way. You could be walking in the Flow Country with the sights and sounds and atmosphere of the Edinburgh festivals and realise why you want to be in the Flow Country.
Yeah, too straight. Yeah. Anyway, that's all we've got time for this week's Scotland Outdoors podcast. Thanks very much for downloading us. We will be popping up midweek too with another podcast, this one looking at the community buyout of the island of Ulva 1 year on. From all of the team here at BBC Aberdeen, thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.